Welcome to the Quilt Fiction Story Guild podcast, a podcast exclusively for members of the Quilt Fiction Story Guild. I'm Frances O'Rourke Dowell, and thank you for joining us, and as always, thank you for being part of the Quilt Fiction community. Now, on to the story. Family Album, Chapter 5. Because she hates a lie, the first thing Florence does when she gets to work is pens a quick note to her brother Harry inviting herself to Sunday dinner. "I'd love to see what you and Mabel have done to the house," she writes. She could call him at his office, but Harry likes these sort of formal touches. A handwritten message delivered by courier will delight him, and he'll call home right away to tell Mabel to order the best of what the butcher has on offer. She's glad that Harry has taken over the old house on Walnut Street. After years of resisting any kind of change to the Grangerfield ancestral home place, he's given his wife free rein to redecorate. Mabel has been hard at work getting rid of the dark, heavy pieces that Florence's mother had been so enamored of, with their intricate details and needle-pointed upholstery that absorbed dust and something else that Florence couldn't quite name. The feeling that time had come to a standstill at the end of Queen Victoria's reign, perhaps. It's unfortunate that Mabel's taste veers toward the gaudy, not just in furniture, but in wallpaper and window dressings as well. She likes to mix pinks and reds and punch things up with jade. It's a very 1920s palette, and Florence wonders if her sister-in-law is trying to relive her youth, those happy days when she ran around with a racy group of girls who managed to stay on this side of respectable society, but only barely. Mabel is a few years older than Florence, enough so that their paths never crossed until she and Harry became an item. Florence's feelings for her over the years haven't changed much. Her sister-in-law is a bit crass, a bit too free with her opinions, especially her opinions about Florence's impending spinsterhood. "What you need to do," Mabel had advised recently, having had a touch too much to drink, "is get yourself a matchmaker, one that works for rich people. I bet you could find yourself a rich widower just like that. I'd act quick, though. The dew on your rose is about to dry up, if you get my drift." All the same, as far as Florence can tell, the woman means well, and her opinions are always offered cheerfully and seemingly without malice. Funny to have two such different sisters-in-law, Florence thinks as she walks to Nettie's office, her note to Harry in hand. There is no love lost between Emmeline and Mabel. Emmeline is a snob, and Mabel is tacky and a bit coarse, her blonde beauty fading from years of too much rich food and drink. Emmeline says Mabel has gone to seed, and Florence supposes there's something to that, but she has a good heart, and she's a good, if overindulgent, mother to her three children. It's only recently occurred to Florence that both of her brothers married women from the lower rungs of the social ladder. She wonders if they were reacting to their own parents' marriage, which had been more or less arranged by their parents in a bid to bring two financial strongholds together, with little thought given to the compatibility of the bride and groom. "Good morning, Miss Grangerfield," Nettie greets her from the desk when Florence appears in her doorway. As always, Florence admires how artfully arranged Nettie's desk is, how it's not just orderly, but also aesthetically pleasing. Every few days, Nettie brings something fresh to fill the Delft china vase that sits at the desk's right-hand corner. Today's offering is a branch of bright red maple leaves. "Good morning, Nettie." Florence holds out Harry's card. "Could you ask Jasper to deliver this to Harry by the end of the day, please?" "Home or office?" Florence flips through the morning mail, but finds nothing of interest. Office, please. Certainly, Miss Grangerfield. Oh, and I'm to tell you that Mamie Betts would like to see you when you have a moment. Mamie Betts works on the fourth floor sewing room. While she doesn't have an official title, she is essentially the quilting company's foreman, overseeing the other women and keeping the sewing machines in good repair. Apart from Nettie, she is Florence's most valued employee. Is there a problem with one of the machines? She didn't say what the problem was, ma'am, Nettie says. Florence wishes Nettie wouldn't call her ma'am, but she's learned to accept it. She once asked Dorothy if she thought perhaps Nettie might call her by her first name, given how closely they worked together. But Dorothy was adamantly opposed. Don't rob Nettie of her dignity, Florence, she'd advised. She's proud to be your secretary and wants to be proper in every detail. Florence understands, though it does make her feel a bit lonely to be called Miss and Ma'am all the day long. She guesses she can always phone Mabel when she's feeling that way, what with her honeys and sugars and sweetie pies. Honestly, a woman like Mabel could make you positively hungry to be called Ma'am. The rest of her day is given over to the business of running a company, which means scheduling and attending meetings, making decisions and phone calls, and dictating letters. And, of course, editing a catalog. It's 6 p.m. before Florence even looks up from the pile of papers on her desk to find the sky outside her window dark and moonless, and everyone else gone for the day. As she makes her way to her car, she considers going to Linway's for dinner for a second night in a row. But the thought of eating alone at a diner depresses her almost as much as the thought of walking into her dark, empty house does. And she has no doubt that her house will be dark and empty. She's managed to put this morning's exchange out of the way for the day, but now it resurfaces, demanding to be reckoned with. What happened, she wonders, as she drives down George Road. Was it Finn's look of pity, poor childless Florence, that set her off? Well, of course it was. What else could it be? Just as she expected, there is no sign of Finn and Leo when Florence arrives home. But when she walks into the house, she discovers that lights are on in the living room and kitchen. Perhaps Finn forgot to turn them off when he left. That wouldn't be like him, though, as concerned as he is about electrical fires. No, Florence feels certain he left them on, so she won't have to fumble with the lamps and run into walls on her way to the kitchen. They might be at odds with one another, but apparently that doesn't make Finn any less considerate. Depositing her coat and bag in the hall closet and exchanging her street shoes for slippers, Florence notices how quiet the house is. Is it always this quiet when no one else is around? Really, she should know, as much time as she spends on her own here. But rarely after a day at work, she realizes. She's gotten used to coming home from work and hearing the sounds of Finn's hammer and Leo's sweet humming as he works on some project or another in the kitchen. Well, Tibbs, she tells the cat, who has followed her into the kitchen, I guess those days are over. It was bound to happen sooner or later. She marches bravely to the icebox. What shall I have for dinner, Tibbs? There's some cheese, and I seem to recall seeing half a loaf of bread in the cupboard last night. She should put in a supply of canned things, sardines and tuna, a few tins of peaches, Florence thinks as she looks for the bread. When she moved into the new house earlier in the fall, she relieved Daisy of her cooking duties and made plans to make herself simple dinners, a chop one night, tomato soup the next. But of course, that's not how things unfolded. It's a moment before Florence notices that her usual place at the kitchen table has been set with a spoon, fork, and a neatly folded napkin, and that her water glass and the bread basket have been filled. When Florence opens the icebox to look for the cheese, she finds that Finn has left a bowl of stew for her. For a moment, she thinks she might cry, but then she sees that a few inches away from the bowl is a teacup filled with dirt and planted with three tiny sticks, and she laughs instead. She sets the cup next to the bread basket and carries the bowl to the stove, where she pours its contents into a pot and lights the flame. As the lovely scent of lamb stew lifts into the air, Tibby wraps himself around Florence's ankles. How lucky she is to have a little cat who takes care of her, Florence thinks as she stirs the stew. How lucky she is to be cared for. In the morning, she leaves for work earlier than usual, but before she goes, she puts a note on the table. "Dear Finn," it reads, "if the invitation is still open, I would very much like to have dinner at your mother's on Sunday. Tell her I'm looking forward to meeting the woman who raised you." Chapter 6. It's a mid-December Sunday, and snow is threatening. While Florence doesn't relish dashing out to the steps to retrieve her newspaper, she knows the impending snow will leave its pages a soggy, unreadable mess if she doesn't. Carrying the paper into the living room, she's glad she's already lit a fire. Only a few seconds outside has her shivering. Fortunately, she has Tibby to keep her warm. She scoops up the cat and takes a seat on the red Art Deco lounge chair, which has become her favorite reading perch. First, she wants to see if any new quilting patterns are on the ladies' page. The Dispatch carries both Nancy Page and Florence Leganke's columns, and while neither of them design quilt patterns as lovely as Eula's or Emmeline's, she never knows what ideas they might inspire. But instead of Nancy Page and Florence Leganke, Florence finds, well, Florence Grangerfield. The article, which she's more or less forgotten about, takes up several columns worth of space. Its headline announcing, "Milton Falls Woman Finding Success in Spite of Hard Times." There's her photograph, the same one that runs in the quilting company's catalog, a headshot she had done professionally at McCormick's photography studio on Center Street. It's a flattering enough shot, although it appears a bit smudged here, as if someone ran his finger over it before the ink was dry. Oh well, Florence has never been particularly vain about her looks, having little cause to be, and there's no use starting now. A second photograph features building number 5 from the vantage point of the riverbank, and Florence proudly notes her second floor office window, thinking what a fine thing it is to have one's own office, and for that matter, one's own building. Much better than being a great beauty, she thinks, with a satisfied nod. The third photograph that accompanies the article is of the family house on Walnut Street. Why not her Orange Street cottage? The paper sent a photographer out a few days after the reporter's visit, and he'd snapped a dozen or so shots. As she begins to read, Florence quickly understands why none of them were used. While the article's opening paragraphs are dedicated to the quilting company's beginnings and its current success, accurately outlining the many facets of the business, most of the content concerns itself with the origins of the Grangerfield and Sons Insurance Company and the Grangerfield family's place in Milton Falls society. Florence's success, the author strongly suggested, was due as much to her family finances as to any business acumen she might possess. It doesn't hurt, moreover, that she is related to Emmeline Grangerfield, the popular quilting columnist for the Farmer's Wife magazine. Florence takes a deep breath, rubs Tibby behind his tiny gray ears, and resists the temptation to throw the paper in the fire. What did Father used to say? Today's newspaper is tomorrow's fish wrap. Anyone who knows anything about Florence and her family will recognize that the article is riddled with errors. Harry is referred to as Henry, for one thing, and Emmeline is described as a former Milton Falls debutante, which she won't like a bit, having been snubbed by the debutante crowd when she first moved to town. Florence understands that, of course, people want to read about well-off families in times like these. Moreover, there's no denial that Florence's success is rooted in her family's wealth. She earned none of the money it took to start the Milton Falls Quilting Company, or that she used to buy Building Number 5. But, she exclaims so forcefully that Tibby scrambles off of her lap, but it takes more than inherited wealth to create a successful business. It takes intelligence and talent and good ideas. It takes time and commitment. By now she's standing, as if she's giving a speech, even though the only other person in the room is a cat, who is looking at Florence with such a baffled expression that she can't help but laugh. Oh, I'm full of sound and fury, aren't I, old Tibbs? Who cares what the Columbus Dispatch has to say about me and my company? Fact or fiction, as long as we get some new customers and catalog requests out of it, I'll consider it all water under the bridge. She gathers the paper up and sits down to read the news. A man named Joseph Stalin is causing trouble in Russia, it appears, and the stock market is down in Berlin. Lloyd George wants a new deal in Britain. Even though all of these things are happening thousands of miles away from Milton Falls, Florence files each story away in her mind. 18 months into her life as a business owner, she knows that world affairs affect the struggling U.S. economy, which in turn affects the quilting company. All the same, after 20 minutes of reading about the world's woes, she's had enough and flips to the book page. Oh, look at this, Tibbs, she says. Children's encyclopedias. Here are 3 compendiums of knowledge for the youthful reader, each of them deserving the attention of parents who wish to provide their children with a comprehensive work of reference. She puts down the paper and looks at the cat. You know who would absolutely adore an encyclopedia? Leo. Shall we get him one for Christmas? Perhaps that's what we could do with the attic when it's completed. We could set up a little library for him, a study of sorts, and fill it up with books and games and the like. It's a perfectly marvelous idea, but for the fact that Finn has recently told her he'll be done with the attic renovation before Christmas and has another client to attend to after that, a commission he was supposed to begin in October but has put off in order to finish his work on Florence's house. Florence almost asked if he and Leo would still be coming over for dinner. No, what she almost asked is if they would still be coming home for dinner, and she only just managed to stop the words from coming out of her mouth. This was not their home, and Finn and Leo are not Florence's family. So what on earth is she doing imagining a library for Leo in the attic? It's for the future, Florence tells herself. Over the last month, she and Finn have discussed the other plans for the house and property, the larger bath upstairs, the greenhouse Daisy hopes for. He says he can start work in late spring, midsummer at the latest. So why not make a small room for Leo in the attic? Though, won't the attic be awfully hot in the summer? Perhaps Finn could install some sort of electric fans. Florence walks to the kitchen to make herself a cup of tea. She can always make a room for Leo on the second floor. The small bedroom at the end of the hall would be perfect. Why, she should have done that ages ago. He takes his naps on the settee in the living room, but how much better to have his own bed upstairs. She's seen the bedroom Finn's mother keeps for Leo in her home, and while it's lovely, it's not quite Leo. It's been several weeks since she had Sunday dinner with Finn's family, his mother and a younger brother visiting from Cincinnati, as well as Finn and Leo, of course, and she enjoyed it so very much. Mrs. Wyman gave Florence a tour before they sat down to eat, leading her first to the study where her late husband read after dinner while the young Finn sat at the ornate roll-top desk and designed plans for forts and treehouses. "Which he then built out back, using his brothers for labor," Mrs. Wyman laughed. "I could never put in a garden. There were always hammers and planks strewn about." "Did he walk around with a pencil tucked behind his ear?" Florence asked. "Honestly, tonight is the first time I've ever seen him without one." "He was never without pencil, paper, and a completely outlandish idea," Mrs. Wyman reported. Finn, who had joined them on the tour, protested. "Nothing outlandish about a three-story house. If you'd let me build the second and third story, Mother, you would have seen that." Over a dinner of roast beef and scalloped potatoes, the talk of childhood projects and fascinations had continued. "When I was Leo's age, I liked nothing better than to make fairy gardens," Florence recalled. "I used to leave the fairies treats, and sometimes they returned the favor." "That was your parents who did that, not fairies," Leo told her. "There's no such thing as fairies, except in books." Florence pretended to be shocked by this news. "No fairies? Why, Leo, who ever told you such a thing?" And the boy shrugged. "No one told me. But if there were fairies, the rabbits would eat them." Florence and Finn exchanged glances across the table, and Florence tilted her head as if to say, "Perhaps you should take it from here." "Maybe the rabbits do eat the fairies," Finn agreed, and Florence did her best to suppress a giggle. "Or maybe the fairies know how to stay out of the rabbits' way."
"So you think there are fairies?" Leo sounded dubious.
Mrs. Wyman stepped in. "Most adults have forgotten all about fairies, Leo. However, I can see that Miss Grangerfield still remembers, as do I."
"I'm a child right now, and I don't remember," Leo argued. "So either there aren't any fairies, or else the rabbits eat them."
Florence held her napkin to her face so that Leo couldn't see her smiling. "Perhaps the rabbits eat some of the fairies," Finn's brother Adam offered, "but not all of them. Maybe the rabbits only eat the evil fairies." With that, Florence excused herself from the table, fearing she might fall out of her seat in a fit of laughter. I need to powder my nose," she said, pushing back her chair. As she headed for the hallway, she could hear Leo asking,
"What does that mean? Powder your nose. What kind of powder? Gunpowder?"
Florence had enjoyed the whole evening enormously. Mrs. Wyman shared Finn's easygoing disposition, though, like her son, she had an eye for detail and liked things to be just so. Dinner was a relaxed affair, but there wasn't a fork or knife out of place, and there had been three courses, complimentary flavors threaded throughout each. Mrs. Wyman had made both the potatoes and the cranberry pie, or, as she put it, the interesting dishes. "Roasting meat requires very little imagination," she told Florence as the adults were drinking their coffee in the living room after dinner. "But making a cheese sauce? One must put one's heart and soul into it for it to be any good at all." "And a dash of paprika," Finn added, "though not too much."
That's right, his mother agreed. Too much and the paprika takes over.
I'm not familiar with paprika, Florence admitted. Is it a plant?
Mrs. Wyman reached over and patted Florence on the arm. It is a spice, my dear, and you have to order it from Chicago. Its origins are in South America, but somehow the Hungarians got a hold of it, and then I did.
Florence took a sip of coffee and then asked, Was your family originally from Hungary?
No, but they're always hungry, Leo exclaimed, laughing, and then he looked to his father. I made a joke, Finn. Did you hear it?
Finn grinned. I did, and it was a good joke indeed. Miss Grangerfield, what is your opinion on Leo calling his father by his first name?
Mrs. Wyman sounded genuinely curious.
Is it a good modern idea, or will it prove damaging in the long run?
Florence glanced at Finn, whose expression suggested that he was as interested in her opinion as his mother was.
Well, it's my understanding that it was Leo's idea to call Finn by his first name, Florence began. Perhaps because, well, that's the only name he's heard Finn referred to by. If his... Much to Florence's relief, Finn took over.
Florence is exactly right. If Martha were alive, she would have referred to me as Papa around Leo. Leo, go tell Papa that it's time for dinner. Leo, go take Papa's hat.
But you know all this already, Mother. Why bring it up?
Because, as you know, I don't approve, Mrs. Wyman admitted. And if Florence doesn't approve, well, that's another vote in my favor.
I approve, Leo said from the floor, where he was looking at a book about trees.
Florence laughed. And I'm not getting involved. It's a family matter.
Mrs. Wyman gave her a long look.
Yes, I suppose it is, she said finally.
This is delicious coffee, Mrs. Wyman, Florence said, holding up her cup. I find that I drink more tea than coffee these days, just because those new tea bags make tea so easy to brew.
They are very practical, Mrs. Wyman agreed. Now, Miss Grangerfield, can I interest you in another piece of pie?
She could, and Florence enjoyed the second piece of pie as much as the first. She enjoyed everything about the evening, she thinks now, as she heads to the kitchen. She's having Sunday dinner with Harry and Mabel tonight, and she knows she won't have half as much fun as she did at the Wyman's, especially since Harry will complain about his name being wrong in the paper, and Mabel will complain about not being mentioned at all.
Thanks for joining us on the Quilt Fiction Story Guild podcast, a production of Milton Falls Media, Incorporated. All rights reserved. Until next time, this is Frances O'Rourke Dow. Thank you for joining us.